Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show,
the smooth talk of the town.
Cool. We are back on the Andy Finn Show on WEVR Radio here in Fairfax County, Virginia. And we're talking about Scott McClellan's book and the flap it has caused. So the fourth interesting point that I found in this book was that he claims the networks basically rolled over for the Bush administration and they didn't do their jobs. Now, what's interesting is how the networks have covered this. They aren't very happy with this, either the cable networks or the commercial networks, because they don't want to believe that that's true. I think McClellan's right about this. There certainly was anti-war sentiment at the time, but we were less than a year removed from 9/11, and everybody was too timid to question the Bush administration. Of course, I mostly fault the Bush administration for taking us into Iraq because, you know, the talking points you hear from Republicans and conservatives are always, well, the Democrats saw the same intelligence and they voted with us. And that's true. By the same token, we've pointed this out on this show many times. George W. Bush, Cheney, Rove, they forced the Congress to vote right before the 2002 election. And the Democrats wanted it off their agenda. They didn't want a protracted battle over this resolution because they wanted to move on to domestic issues and see if they could win some seats. They knew that this was a winning issue for Bush, so they dispatched it as quickly as possible. And Bush and Rove knew that would take place. Contrast that with what Bush's father did. He refused to make this a political game during the 1990 election. He waited till the election was over, and then he asked Congress for a vote of conscience about the Iraq War, or the Gulf War, really, is what it's called. But beyond that, the other argument you hear from conservatives and Democrats about the war is, well, all the other intelligence agencies in the world thought he had weapons of mass destruction, too. That's true, but none of them wanted to go to war over it. None of them. Even England didn't want to go to war. Bush talked Tony Blair into going along. And then Blair was a hawk once he made a once he realized Bush was going to war, he stuck with him. But there was plenty of anti-war sentiment in this country. It's just that the Bush administration took the opportunity post 9/11 to steamroll the country. And I said this at the time, you know, I was once in a political battle in the corporate world where it seemed to me the only thing that the other side, we were arguing over going to market with one product versus another. And it seemed to me that one side just wanted to win. They didn't care what they did to win, meaning they didn't mind misrepresenting facts, inflating their figures, deflating the figures for the other product that had a decent case to be made for it. They weren't interested in an intellectual discussion that made the best decision. They were interested in winning, and they didn't really think of the results, what would happen after they won. They just wanted to win this battle and then worry about it later. Well, what happened in the corporate situation was they won, they got their way, they went to market with the product that they wanted to go to market with, which had substantial risk and downside. And then when the product didn't sell well and they fell flat on their faces, they didn't have allies. Because they alienated everybody was on the other side, everybody that had worked on the development of the internal product, everybody that thought it was a safer bet. They didn't cultivate that. They didn't show respect for those points of view. And so when they were in trouble and needed allies, the allies weren't there. Those people deserted them and said, hey, you made your choice. We told you that we could give you a good product at a good price. And you were too impatient and went with an outside vendor whose product was untested. You made your bed, now lie in it. And there was quite a bit of glee on the other side, the fact that these folks got burned because all they cared about was winning. They weren't that interested in a fair evaluation of the two products. Well, I got to tell you, that's pretty much what happened during the Iraq War, the lead up to it. That's all I could think of was I watched people like Condi Rice and then Cheney and Bush go on TV and say, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Every time they ran into a roadblock and the country wasn't going to let them go to war, they upped the stakes. First of all, they conflated WMDs. That's a terrible expression to use, weapons of mass destruction. Separate them out for me, please. You're talking chemical, biological, or nuclear. Each one is worse than the other. Chemical weapons aren't going to kill millions of people. It's a horrific way to go, but it's not like it makes Saddam the most dangerous man in the world. Even biological weapons can be relatively contained. The sarin gas attacks in the Tokyo subways killed 78 people. That's nothing to sneeze at, but it's hardly the equivalent of a nuclear weapon. Killing a small nuke, killing 100,000 people in a major American city or more, maybe a million. And that's what Bush eventually had to threaten or say was the threat before the country would let him go to war. He had to say, you have to worry about nukes. You have to worry about them nuking us. Well, as soon as I heard those words come out of Condi Rice's mouth, I was incensed. And if you're a regular listener, you know I was incensed because I've talked about this many times. I yelled back at my radio, and I can't even tell you what I said, meaning I don't dare repeat it, when she said we don't want the... That was the first time the administration floated this line that Bush, that Cheney repeated and then Bush repeated. We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud over an American city. I yelled back at my radio and I said, you... And it wasn't the B word, but I knew what trash that was. Totally unfit for the National Security Advisor, the Vice President, or the President, but they all said it. So, when we say the networks rolled over, it's true they did. But the Bush administration had a chance post 9/11 to lead in a reputable way, in a statesmanlike way, and they chose to steamroll the country and get their way to go to war with Iraq. So it, regardless of what else you think about them, that is whether they broke laws to do that, and there's some evidence they did, this is their war. You can't blame the Democrats for this, and you can't blame our allies or other security agents, and you can't blame the CIA. This is Bush and Cheney's war. Now, back to the Scott McClellan's point that the networks rolled over. He's right, they did. Post 9/11, there was no stomach for calling the people on this. But we've got to have a strong press that calls demagogues on this, because that's what it was. It was, in the words of the great communicator, this is sheer demagoguery. And it was demagoguery that they pulled on us. And the networks, the press, let them get away with it. Part of the problem was that we had Judy Miller at the New York Times writing her stories. She was being spoon-fed information from the Bush administration, which was off base to begin with. And the administration itself didn't have a decision-making apparatus inside it that could give you checks and balances. You know, they isolated Colin Powell and they didn't want to hear from him. And there's no one in the White House has ever said, yes, we had a policy meeting where we sat down, we kicked it around, we argued about the pros and cons. We had people playing devil's advocate, and we actually discussed whether or not to go to war. Everybody says, I was never asked what I thought about going to war. Pretty interesting, really. So the press needs to stand up in those situations and ask the right questions, and it did not. So McClellan's right. And the press, when his book came out last week, didn't really want to cover this ground. But they are culpable. And then finally, the last issue here is this really McClellan talking? Now, the talking points that come out of the White House and conservatives and Republicans were immediately, this doesn't sound like Scott McClellan. And of course, that's the kind of thing they're going to say. The other talking points are, gee, why, if he felt so strongly, why didn't he speak up, you know, when he was here and not wait and cash in with a multi-million dollar book afterwards? Fair question. Except that inside the bubble, as he refers to it, or when you're inside of a group like that, you don't, dissent of that level is not tolerated. Plus, he's only the press secretary. You know, he's not like he was a real policymaker. But those are the usual things you hear, you know, when a tell-all book is written, And what happens is if the tell-all book is written against a Democrat, it's Democrats and liberals that complain, and conservatives are fine with it and think he's an upstanding American. Well, we got the reverse here, and that's what liberals and Democrats think, is that Scott McClellan's finally seen the light and he's a fine, upstanding American. But this issue of whether it's really McClellan is interesting. There were a couple of articles about it today. Like I say, Robert Novak, the Prince of Darkness, dealt with the Valerie Plame leak case. And his case was that McClellan doesn't mention Armitage but twice, who made the original leak, and he doesn't mention him until long after he discusses the leak. Well, what he needs to realize, of course, is that McClellan is much more concerned with Rove and Libby because they're the guys that lied to him. But his point is that the way the story is written and framed, it sounds like it was written by a Democrat. And if you can believe, not Josh Bolton, who was the chief of staff, Ari Fleischer, the previous press secretary, said to McClellan apparently, hey, what gives? You've written a pretty scathing book here, or whatever he said. And McClellan said, well, yeah, my editor kind of tweaked it for me. So basically, it was published by a liberal editor and press that publishes other liberal books. And the claim is that they convinced Scott that to make money or to sell or to be controversial enough, you got to really be tough on your old boss. So they're saying he was duped, talked into it, although if you saw him on any of the talk shows, he's not backing down. He's not saying that that's true, what Ari Fleischer says he told him. Of course, when you're talking to an old friend like Ari Fleischer, you may soft pedal what you did. But it is interesting, and I've got an open mind about whether McClellan was, this book was partially ghostwritten. That is, he was talked into this, or other people wrote segments of it. And, you know, he might not have even read it carefully. That's what some authors do when they get a good ghostwriter. So it may be that this isn't really all McClellan's work, and it is really written at the hands of Democrats, or a Democrat, or a ghostwriter that sees a Democratic point of view. But be that as it may, McClellan's standing by it, so it's a headache first for Bush, but it's also a headache for John McCain, and here's why. McCain is right now staking out Iraq as an issue he thinks he can come out ahead on. So he's taken on Barack Obama on Iraq, which, because he thinks the surge is working, he thinks is going to be a good strategy. When we come back from the break, though, we're going to talk about that and move into the election campaign, and we will find out whether it actually makes sense that the Iraq war is going to play well for John McCain. We'll see.
Hi, I'm Andy Finn. You know, even if someone handed me $1 million this morning, I'd still be doing my radio show on WEBR. Why? Because I have commitment. I have dedication. Plus, I signed a contract. Now, if you'll do the same, I'll have one more dedicated listener. Don't worry. You can void your contract if I ever get obsessed with liberals, or gays, the flag, the pledge, embryonic stem cells, the UN, illegal immigrants, missing white women, or the country of France. So tune in the Andy Finn Show on WEBR, Mondays from 11 to midnight. Hey, if you had $1 million, you could buy a radio station.
How true. And I don't, so I won't. So here we are on WEBR Radio. And let's move on to the election. We already mentioned that Hillary Clinton won Puerto Rico. We already mentioned that Florida and Michigan delegates have been decided. The Democratic Party settled that this weekend. The Clinton campaign's not happy. I'm not sure the Obama campaign is either, except that it's settled. So there isn't going to be a floor fight over Florida and Michigan. However, the way they solved it was what they said they were going to do all along, which was you only get half a vote. So all the delegates can go to the convention and party, but they each only get half a vote, which means they've been punished for holding their primaries too early. And Obama's that much closer to the nomination. it should be over this week because he'll win two states tomorrow. She'll get some delegates. He'll get a few delegates. And then the superdelegates will make their decision. And if 30 to 50 of them break for Obama this week, it is all over. I assume what will happen is Hillary will concede. She will put her campaign on hold. She will suspend her campaign, but not end it, as everyone else has done, because it's possible, and frankly, that's the right decision for the Democratic Party in this regard. If Obama's campaign were to blow up in the next 2 months, we've got until September 1, when he's nominated, to switch horses and go to Hillary. So if something awful were to come out about him, then she'd be waiting in the wings. And so I think she'll suspend her campaign. But all this talk that she's going to take this fight all the way to the convention, and it is true that Harold Ickes this weekend said, I can't believe we're going to substitute our judgment for 600,000 people. This is the decision, I think, in Michigan, where Obama was given delegates, even though his name wasn't on the ballot, because she was the only one that left her name on the ballot. All the other candidates removed their name from the ballot because the party said it wasn't going to count. So Michigan and Florida have caused a lot of trouble, but it looks like it's settled now. And barring any unforeseen events, I don't think Hillary's going to do what Rush Limbaugh would like her to do, which is fight all the way to the convention. I think she's going to suspend her campaign here, hold on to a thin possibility of her being needed later. But meanwhile, Obama gets enough votes for the nomination. People essentially rally around him, and the Democratic Party starts coming back together and addressing John McCain. So I think that part's settled, despite what Rush Limbaugh would like to see happen. And another big news item this week, Obama quit his church. Of course, this Reverend Michael Flager gave this sermon, I guess you call it, in which he mocked Hillary and said that she thought she cried because she was losing her entitlement, her nomination to this black man who came out of nowhere, and doesn't he know I'm white, I'm entitled, all this crap. What's interesting is this guy's a Catholic priest. Now, Obama's not Catholic. Oh, he's also white, this guy. Obama's not Catholic. Obama's not white. Actually, we could just as easily call Obama white as black, right? He's half white. He's half black. But we always refer to him as a black man. I guess that goes back to the old days when if you were 1/16th black, you were considered black. But this is a white Catholic priest who's a bit of a radical on the left. And yet, I don't see why Obama's responsible for a Catholic's statements or a priest's statements or a white guy's statements, but he is, apparently, because it happened in his church. So he left the church and said, you know, this is more headache than it's worth. That's not what he said, but that's what he's doing. And he needed to do it just to put it behind him. Now, will it be behind him completely? No, there'll be ads in September and October about this, but it hadn't hurt him so much so far. We'll see if it fades by then. But that's just a three-ring circus. You know, Pastor Hagee and Parsley, I get my Parsleys and my Paisleys mixed up. When McCain distanced himself from both of them, they know enough to lay low. They're not going to cause trouble for the Republican nominee. But for some reason, the liberals on Obama's side don't see the reason to keep a lid on it and not try to hurt his chances for election. That's pretty interesting stuff. Anyway, let's get back in our last section here to McCain and Obama, because basically this election is going to come down to several issues. It's going to come down to Iraq, either first or second, and it's going to come down to the economy, either first or second. And I don't know which will be a bigger deal, but $4 gas may actually trump Iraq at this point. And Democrats usually win on domestic issues, so they will win on the economy issue. So McCain has already staked out Iraq as his issue. Now, you would think, in view of the fact that 58% of the people in this country want us out, that, and 58% too think that it was a mistake to go in, you would think that Iraq wouldn't be a good issue to hitch your wagon to, except that that's part of McCain's position all along. He believes it sincerely, and he feels he's got stronger credentials than Barack Obama does on national security, so he'd rather fight this on national security. If they fight it on domestic issues, McCain loses, because it'll be the economy, it'll be the price of gas, it'll be trade agreements, it'll be that kinds of stuff, and McCain loses automatically. So he's got to make it about national security. Now, if he's smart, he'll make it about terrorism, but of course, without another terrorist attack, people aren't that concerned. So what he's done is he's made it about Iraq again. And so it's interesting, the little flaps that have gone back and forth, and unless you're following this stuff close, you're not being troubled by all of this. But McCain has basically been chiding Obama and saying he's too inexperienced to be president. He doesn't have the knowledge or the background, all of that stuff. And Obama is given as good as he gets. And one of the reasons why Democrats should be heartened is that, well, John Kerry didn't seem to have this kind of fire in his belly, this kind of fight. Obama is not letting any attack go unanswered. For example, after McCain said, hey, you should go to Iraq, now the conservatives and Republicans are trying to claim, you know, Obama's got to go to visit Iraq, and he should go over with John McCain, and John McCain will show him around or something, and he should meet with General Petraeus, as though you have to be there to see what's going on. Right? Here's Obama's response to that. Quote, for all the travel he's done, what we're looking at is John McCain wanting to double down on George Bush's foreign policy to leave our troops there for 100 years instead of putting pressure on the Iraqis to come to some sort of reconciliation. Not a bad response. So basically, Obama's saying, it's not about experience, it's about judgment. And John McCain's had the wrong judgment. And McCain is saying, I've got decades of experience in foreign policy. This is not the time to put in a newbie, a new guy. So interesting perspective, interesting battle going back and forth. If Obama's the new guy, though, McCain's got to stop putting his foot in his mouth. If you remember, a few weeks ago, he confused Shia and Sunni and basically said that Iran was taking in al-Qaeda and training them in Iran and then sending them back. Well, of course, al-Qaeda in Iraq it's only about 5% of the terrorists or foreign fighters, whatever you want to call them. Not foreign fighters, but terrorists. And they are Sunnis. They're part of the Sunni insurgency, not the Shia insurgency. Well, Iran is Shia, so Iran is allied with the Shias. And that's the whole reason that Bush shouldn't have gone in the first place. We knew this was going to happen. We knew if you create a power vacuum that Iran becomes more powerful because 60% of the country is Shia. And you take the Sunnis out of power, and that's what Saddam Hussein was, you're going to and try and put in some kind of democracy, you're going to give the Shia, or just by sheer numbers, if it comes down to strongmen, if it comes down to civil war, the Shia win, they'll ally with Iran because they're both Shia. So McCain had that little mistake, and he made it three times in two different conversations till Joe Lieberman whispered in his ear and straightened him out. But then yesterday, the day before yesterday now, a couple days ago, McCain came out and said that we have reduced our troop levels to pre-surge levels now, and so we're right back where we were, et cetera, et cetera. Well, then it was pointed out to him that, no, we're not at pre-surge levels. We're scheduled to be there in July, but right now we've got 155,000 troops there. Pre-surge was 130,000. So the surge was only supposed to be between first 21,000 and then 29,000. I think we ended up with like 35,000 surge, but we've still got 25,000 there. So far we've only drawn down 10,000. Actually, I think we were at 160 at one point, so I think we've only drawn down 5,000. He says there's three brigades home, which would be almost 15,000. But the point is that he said we're at pre-surge levels. That's 130,000. We're at 155. So Democrats come out and help Obama. John Kerry came out and said, look, John McCain's a friend of mine, but this is the problem with trying to be commander-in-chief. If you don't know how many troops you've got in Iraq, how do you know whether or not you're stressing the U.S. military beyond what it can handle. His point was rather hidden, and that is that we've known all along the surge could only last 15 months because we don't have the troops to keep rotating them in and keep forces that high there. So we've got to draw down. And by July, we're supposed to get to pre-surge levels, 130,000. But when McCain was confronted with his mistake and told that, hey, Senator McCain, did you know you misspoke here? This is wrong. John Kerry's attacking you. Obama's attacking you. He held firm, and he said, oh, this is just semantics. And his campaign said, and Republican defenders said, this is just semantics. They're talking about tenses, meaning he meant to say we will have been down to pre-surge levels. I'm sorry, but when Obama makes a little mistake, like I visited 57 states, people seem to think it's important. So obviously what happens here is it comes down to your candidate and your perspective. And whatever side you're on, you're going to try and magnify the other guy's mistakes. But McCain's going to have a little harder sell since he hasn't corrected himself on this. He really needs to correct this mistake and make it sound like each mistake he's made is just a misstatement. When you stick to your misstatements, that's a problem. So we'll have to see. But right now, that's one of the issues they're fighting it out on. Another one they're fighting it out on is character. Because in addition to Iraq, the economy, and then just the general war on terror, we've got the issue of character. And actually, there's not going to be time to tackle the character issue here, so I'm just going to say one more thing about the Iraq situation. And that's this. The Iraq war is related to the war on terror, but it's not integral to it. That is, we didn't have a terrorism problem in Iraq before we went in. We have one now, and so it has to be dealt with. But the real issue for the country is, do you want 8 more years of Bush's approach to fighting terrorism, which means essentially confrontation, we're going to go in with our military when we feel we need to and deal with things? Or do you want a foreign policy that says, you know, let's talk to our allies. Let's make sure we've got consensus before we try and accomplish certain goals, because you get farther when you bring the whole world along. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I don't know how it's going to play out, but the Republicans, the conservative talk show hosts, will try and scare America enough and convince you that we're not safe with Obama. But in fact, if you ask the old question Ronald Reagan did in another way, are you better off today? Are we safer today than we were the day after 9/11 or the day George Bush took office? I got to tell you, the answer is no. First of all, Osama bin Laden's still on the loose. Now, McCain just said a couple weeks ago, I'm going to get bin Laden. Yeah, Bush said that too. It's not about talking tough and getting bin Laden. It's the fact that the approach we've used so far going into Iraq was a distraction. That's why Obama wants to get out, is we have more important things to do in the world than Iraq. Now, the Republicans want to say, oh, it'll be a disaster if you pull out. I think Obama's point, and he's not being very articulate about this, is, hey, guess what, folks? It's probably going to be a disaster no matter when we pull out. Because there's going to be a power vacuum when we pull out, and people are going to fight over it, and people are going to die. That's the cost of going in and breaking it, as we did. And I haven't heard him come out and quite say that, but I've been saying that on this show for quite some time. So with that, we will leave it at that and come back next week on June 9th. So that'll do it for another edition of the Andy Finn Show here on WEBR Radio. You can listen to my past shows as podcasts or read my writings at my website, andyfinn.us. That's andyfinn.us. Until then, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.